Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
Welcome to Administrative Remedies. Last time, we were talking about the Major Questions Doctrine and about how it comes in two flavors, the weak version, which is really just statutory interpretation, that says if it's unclear whether or not the statute would include this, we'll assume it doesn't. And the strong version, which says even if it really does seem like the statute includes this, we'll still say it doesn't unless Congress has functionally said the agency could do that exact thing. So let's start with a student loan case.
Fantastic. Biden v. Nebraska.
So in 2023, the Biden administration tried to cancel up to $20,000 in student debt using the HEROES Act of 2003.
What is the HEROES Act?
It was passed after 9/11 and designed to deal with national emergencies. Here's the key provision.
The secretary may waive or modify any statutory or regulatory provision applicable to the student financial assistance programs under Title IV of the Higher Education Act as the secretary deems necessary in connection with a war on other military operation or national emergency.
So during COVID, which was declared a national emergency, the secretary said, I am using my power under this act to forgive up to $20,000 per borrower because the pandemic was an economic catastrophe.
Waive or modify? I mean, waive means to eliminate, right? So that seems pretty clear.
Yes, that's why I would say the court's applying the strong version here. Here's what Robert said about the economic significance.
It would cancel roughly $430 billion of federal student loan balances, completely erasing the debts of 20 million borrowers and lowering the median amount owed by the other 23 million from $29,400 to $13,600.
$430 billion affecting 43 million borrowers? That's major by any measure. But here's where we can really see that Roberts is using the strong version of the doctrine.
He says the secretary has never previously claimed powers of this magnitude under the HEROES Act.
And then he says that even though waive literally means eliminate, that is not enough to grant the secretary the authority to do this. Here's his version of modify.
So modify carries a connotation of increment or limitation and must be read to mean to change moderately or in minor fashion. And then he says the secretary's new modifications of these provisions were not moderate or minor. Instead, they created a novel and fundamentally different loan forgiveness program. The secretary's plan has modified the CIA provisions only in the same sense that the French Revolution modified the status of the French nobility. It has abolished them and supplanted them with a new regime entirely.
That really is a good quote.
Kudos to you, John.
Yeah. He's essentially saying, for a major question, we're going to need more than statutory language that would very clearly seem to cover the action. We need explicit authorization saying, in this case, you can forgive hundreds of billions of dollars in student loans.
That seems like an impossible standard, though. Congress never writes laws that specifically.
Yes, exactly. So this is what Kagan said in the dissent. Can you read this part?
The majority picks the statute apart piece by piece in an attempt to escape the meaning of the whole. But the whole, the expansive delegation, is so apparent that the majority has no choice but to justify its holding on extra statutory grounds. So the majority resorts, as is becoming the norm, to its so-called major questions doctrine. The statute, read as written, gives the secretary broad authority to relieve a national emergency's effect on borrowers' ability to repay their student loans. The secretary did no more than use that lawfully delegated authority. So the majority applies a rule specifically crafted to kill significant regulatory action by requiring Congress to delegate not just clearly, but also micro-specifically.
She's saying it is unambiguous that what the secretary can do falls within the act. He is waiving the loans of some people. He is modifying the loans of other people. And yet the majority still says that's not good enough.
What is the constitutional theory behind all this? why does the court think it can require extra clear authorization for certain questions?
So the court says this is part of the separation of powers. And the idea here is that certain decisions are so significant, they must be made by Congress, the elected representatives, not by agencies. Here's what he said about this in West Virginia.
Agencies have only those powers given to them by Congress. And enabling legislation is generally not an open book to which the agency may add pages and change the plot line. We presume that Congress intends to make major policy decisions itself, not leave those decisions to agencies.
So this is related to the non-delegation doctrine that we talked about in episode 3. Congress can't just hand over its legislative powers to agencies. So for really major decisions, the court is saying, we need to be extra sure Congress actually meant to delegate that authority.
But doesn't that give the court huge power to decide what counts as major?
It does. That's the criticism. The court has essentially created a constitutional clear statement rule without any textual basis in the Constitution. And Kagan really hammered this part home in Biden v. Nebraska. Here's this section.
In this case, the secretary responsible for carrying out the student loan programs forgave student loans in a national emergency under the core provision of a recently enacted statute empowering him to provide student loan relief in national emergencies. Today's decision thus moves the goalpost for triggering the major questions doctrine. Who knows? By next year, the Secretary of Human Health and Services may be found unable to implement the Medicare program under a broad delegation because his actions, enormous economic impact.
So she's saying the court really is just striking down policies it doesn't like and calling them major questions doctrine without any sort of consistent standard.
Okay, but isn't there something to the idea that really big decisions should be made by Congress, not agencies?
Sure, there's definitely an appeal to that argument. If we're restructuring the entire energy sector, we're forgiving hundreds of billions of dollars in debt, you could say elected representatives should make that call.
That does seem more democratic.
It does, but here's the problem. Congress often can't or won't be specific. And sometimes Congress is intentionally using deliberately broad language because it wants to give agencies flexibility to address problems as they evolve. Kagan talks about this part too.
Congress delegates to agencies often and broadly. And it usually does so for sound reasons, because agencies have expertise Congress lacks, because times and circumstances change and agencies are better able to keep up and respond, because Congress knows that if it had to do everything, many desirable and even necessary things wouldn't get done.
So then she gets really specific about what the majority would have required them to do here.
The doctrine forces Congress to delegate in highly specific terms respecting, say, loan forgiveness of certain amounts of borrowers, of certain incomes during pandemics, of certain magnitudes. Of course, Congress sometimes delegates in that way, but also not often. Because if Congress authorizes loan forgiveness, then what of loan forbearance? And what of the other 10 or 20 or 50 knowable and unknowable things the secretary could do? And should the measure taken, whether forgiveness or forbearance or anything else, always be of the same size or go to the same classes of people, doesn't it depend on the nature and scope of the pandemic and on a host of other foreseeable and unforeseeable factors? You can see the problem. It's hard to identify and enumerate every possible application of a statute to every possible condition years in the future. So again, Congress delegates broadly, except that this court now won't let it reap the benefits of that choice. So we end up paralyzed. Agencies can act without explicit permission, and Congress often won't give that permission.
Right. In this case in particular, it was clear that Congress was acting after a major shock to the U.S. to try and give the secretary power to act when there were other major shocks to the U.S. But the court says, well, they didn't foresee this kind of major shock, so it doesn't count. This is also the case where Kagan says that the major questions doctrine is a get out of text free card, which is cute.
A lot of good lines in this podcast.
I know it is. This is a good one. So it's also understandable given everything we've read. It's like if the babysitter gave the kids ibuprofen for a headache and then the parents came home and got furious. You can't make any sort of medical decision without explicit instructions. So now tonight the kid is having an asthma attack. The babysitter can see that. But she's calling the parents and they're not answering. She's already been yelled once for doing something similar, so she's terrified to go get the kid's asthma inhaler without specific instructions.
So how does this actually work in practice? Are agencies just simply paralyzed right now?
Not completely, but they're definitely being a lot more cautious. They're trying different strategies so they can break big actions into smaller pieces that might not trigger the major questions doctrine.
Well, they're gaming the system.
Or we could say they're working within the constraints that the court has imposed. Instead of one clean power plan, we might have 10 smaller rules that together achieve something similar. Each one alone might not be major.
So does that work?
Nobody knows. The court could say the cumulative effect is major, the doctrine still applies, or it could treat each one individually and let them slide. Agencies are also being much more careful about trying to find explicit statutory authorization and trying to find the clearest possible language in the statute.
Like what?
Like after West Virginia v. EPA struck down generation shifting, the EPA can try and find other provisions of the Clean Air Act that might allow it to do this more clearly. Agencies also can obviously push Congress to pass new explicit authorization.
So will Congress actually do that?
Theoretically, it could. Congress did explicitly give the FDA authority over tobacco in 2009, after Brown v. Williamson. But on most controversial issues, as everybody by this point knows, Congress is generally too divided to act.
So, but what does that mean for ordinary people? How does the major questions doctrine actually affect the way we live?
In ways people might not realize. Now, anytime an agency considers any sort of significant regulation, they have to ask, will the court consider this a major question? And if the answer is yes, they may not act at all.
So less ambitious government action across the board.
Certainly, in some instances, we could still see agencies pushing boundaries, betting that their action won't be seen as major. But there's a lot on the line here. It takes a long time to get these through the agency process. And if the thought is it's just going to be annihilated at the end, agencies have very little incentive to do that.
So it sounds like it creates a lot of uncertainty for different people.
It does. It creates uncertainty for everyone. Businesses don't know if regulations will survive the challenge. Beneficiaries don't know if programs will be struck down. And agencies don't know how aggressive they can be.
Okay, so where is all this heading? Will the court keep expanding major questions doctrine?
That's the big question. Some justices seem to apply it really broadly. Gorsuch has written concurrences saying that he would use it even more aggressively than it's been used, but others seem to want to pump the brakes.
Why would they pump the brakes?
Well, if we take this to its logical extreme, the major questions doctrine can invalidate huge swaths of the administrative state. There are tons of major decisions that agencies make. Drug approvals for major diseases, safety standards for technologies, regulations for airlines, financial regulations after crises. If these all become major questions requiring explicit congressional authorization, agencies can no longer really act. So we could think of an example like Ozempic. Insurance companies have already said this year they're raising insurance rates in part due to the cost they're expecting from so many people taking the drugs. And my rough back-of-the-envelope calculations earlier were that it would be about $100 to $150 billion a year if everyone who could take it on-label, which is type 2 diabetes, used it, and hundreds of billions of more if it was just used for weight loss for everybody eligible. So that certainly sounds like we're remaking a huge part of the economy right there.
This is probably a good time to mention that this podcast is not brought to you by the makers of Ozempic, your favorite GLP-1 supplement.
It's good. I like it. So I think even conservative justices can recognize the danger we're facing here. The question is where they're going to draw the line. Here's what Barrett wrote in her Nebraska concurrence. She joined the majority but seemed concerned about potentially going too far.
She said, "I take seriously the charge that the doctrine is inconsistent with textualism, and I grant that some articulations of the major questions doctrine on offer, most notably that the doctrine is a substantive canon, should give a textualist pause. Yet I do not see the major questions doctrine that way. Rather, I understand it to emphasize the importance of context when a court interprets a delegation to an administrative agency. And seen in this light, the major questions doctrine is a tool for discerning, not departing from, the text's most natural interpretation."
So she's clearly trying to frame the major questions doctrine as the weak version here. This is just careful statutory reading. It's not a super strong clear statement rule. And this may be where the court ends up finding a limiting principle.
So we might see the doctrine stabilize rather than keep expanding.
Potentially. The question isn't whether the major questions doctrine will survive. It will. The question is more, can the court articulate some sort of test so that everybody has an idea of what qualifies as a major questions doctrine? Right now, it can seem like the doctrine expands and contracts depending on whose policy is in front of the court.
What if Congress were to pass a law that simply said, we want you to interpret our agency powers that we grant in as expansive of a manner as possible? Would that bind the court's hands to interpret or to do away with the major questions doctrine?
No. So we're going to talk about Chevron next time. Congress could easily put Chevron back in place. But if we view this as a concern about the constitutional role of the court, that's not something Congress can fix by just saying, please believe we're trying to do stuff within the outer limits of what the Constitution says.
And that seems very problematic. I mean, creates different rules for different policies.
Yes. It makes it look like the doctrine is really about policy preferences, not legal principles. It is also really worth noting that so far, the court has just applied this to Democratic policies. There have been some discussion about whether the court is going to use it for Trump's tariffs. If so, that would be the first explicit use of the major questions doctrine against Republican action. This discrepancy is one reason why people feel so suspicious about the major questions doctrine and that the court is really trying to reach political ends rather than applying the law in a neutral manner. A year ago today, virtually every Democrat wildly hated the major questions doctrine until the tariff case came up, and suddenly Democrats were realizing that maybe they didn't like out-of-control executive action. And that's the important thing about most of these administrative law rules. Unchecked executive power seems really abhorrent when the other party's in control, but right, proper, and necessary when your party is in control.
So let's zoom out. How does the major questions doctrine fit with everything else we've covered this season?
It's all connected. The major questions doctrine, Chevron deference, which we're talking about next time, the push against agency independence, it's all part of a broader skepticism about the administrative state itself.
The court is reigning in agency power across the board.
That is absolutely the trend. We'll be continuing that next episode when we talk about the Chevron doctrine. But we'll spend one episode talking about what the Chevron doctrine was before we get back to the death of Chevron in a different episode.
So that does it for today's episode on Administrative Remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law, because remember, you can't fix what you don't understand.